Okay, everyone, if you want to find a seat, we're going to get started. How's everybody doing? You doing good? I'm glad that you're here this morning. We're going to be studying in John chapter 9. So if you have a Bible, you can turn to John chapter 9. If not, there's some, I guess you call them pew Bibles. They're little gray and blue Bibles that are kind of scattered around a little bit. But before we jump into the text, I'm going to ask you to step outside your comfort zone a little bit. So you should have received one of these if you came in, when you came in. If you don't have one, will you raise your hand and we'll get one to you? Who doesn't have a piece of black fabric? Do we have someone who can? Okay, excellent, excellent, very good. So keep them up. Need three over there. We need a bunch over there. Thanks, Beth. Anybody else? Raise your hand high. Bill's got some over here. We just need everyone to have a... There's one over here. Over to your right, Bill. Somebody grab, you got an extra one? Y'all out. Somebody grab Jess one. There we go. Oh, Heine's one. Okay, here we go. Anybody else? Raise your hand if you don't have one still. Okay. Okay, so what I'm going to ask you to do is just kind of step outside your comfort zone a little bit for a moment and see if we can climb inside this text just a little bit, the one that we read earlier. So this is actually a blindfold. So what I want you to do is just take it and put it, just tie it around your eyes a little bit. I mean, it's not going to totally make you blind, but then just tie it around back and leave it. I'm not going to ask you to do anything. You're just going to be sitting there. But also, I have to take a picture of this because my pastor friends are never going to believe that I got my church to do this, and I'm going to need to post this on Instagram. This is awesome. Okay, so grab it, tie it around your eyes so that you can see, and just we're just kind of leave it there. And I want to just kind of walk us through an imagination exercise here. Imagine, like, for instance, right now you needed to get up and go to the restroom. Like, how would you do that? How would that go for you? That's, by the way, is a rhetorical question. You don't need to answer this out loud. I know your other senses are heightened here, but how would you step around? How many people are in your row? Like, how far is it to the end of the row? Do you remember? How would you navigate the distance to the door? Which door are you headed for? Would you ask for help? How would you navigate a restroom when you can't see? We're talking toilets, clothing, washing, without your eyes. And let's say it was semi-permanent. How are you going to get home from here? How are you going to get home? How are you going to do your job? How are you going to feed yourself? And think about some of the isolation that comes with lack of sight. Like when everybody else is watching TV, what are you going to do? What if you never saw the face of a loved one again? You know, physical blindness impacts almost every arena of life, from the smallest things like just being able to use a restroom to the biggest things like work, friendship, family. And the writer of the Gospel of John, he tells a story about the healing of a blind man, and John uses a real story about Jesus healing a real physical malady to talk about spiritual blindness. And he uses this physical disability in particular that causes a lot of isolation to write to a community of Jesus followers who were increasingly isolated, kicked out of the Jewish community because they followed Jesus. And he seemed to think that spiritual blindness would impact nearly every aspect of our life as well. And so as you're just staying in this moment, just a little bit longer, I want to just read the beginning of this John chapter 9. As he walked along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" How does that make you feel as you sit here in a self-imposed blindness? Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." And when he had said this, he spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva and spread the mud on the man's eyes, saying to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. And he went and washed and came back able to see. And the neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar began to ask, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some were saying, "It is he." Others were saying, "No, but it's someone like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." But they kept asking him, "Then how were your eyes opened?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud, spread it on my eyes, and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' And then he went and washed and received sight." And they said to him, "Where is he?" And he said, "I do not know." Okay, you can remove your blindfolds now. Back to the light. There was a story a few years back in the UK about this man who had been fired from his job for religious reasons. And I clicked on it because I wanted to know what it was. I figured he was like, it was an Islamic thing, or maybe he was a proselytizing at work or something. It turns out he was a British professional soccer coach. He coached one of their soccer teams in Britain. And he had given this interview in which he said that people who were born with birth defects or some kind of disabilities were being punished for the sins of a former lifetime. And I was like, I didn't know. He had some like wackadoo faith healer guy that he was following, some like Euro Christian karma thing. Anyway, he got fired because if you're a public figure, even if you think something like that, you can't say it because it's going to hurt people. But in Jesus's day, this was the dominant view. This is how people thought. If you had a birth defect or something wrong with you, somebody somewhere had done something wrong, right? And we might be tempted to think we're too smart for that today, but we're really not. It's actually common when something bad happens to us to start wondering, do you ever do that? Like, what, God is punishing me? Like, I'm getting punished for something here. It's kind of just a place that we go. It's actually assigning blame. Blame is one of those things we turn to discharge pain. When we're in some kind of pain, we look for something to blame, and then we don't have to feel responsible for the pain. If we can assign blame, we don't have an obligation to suffer with those who are in pain or suffer for them even. And that's how it was in Jesus' culture. So the blind man probably spent his whole life being looked down upon by his culture, being blamed, being ignored or judged. He was disabled and they found that depressing, right? He was a beggar and people found that demanding, but it was actually a little less depressing and demanding if they could find somebody to blame for it. That way they could walk by him every day without having to feel bad for him, and especially without having to feel responsible for him. So he spent his whole life either being seen as a pain or just being made invisible. People who saw him but didn't really see him. He was not only blind, people made themselves blind to him. And so the disciples aren't actually being cruel. They're just asking the obvious question in their time and their day. Who sinned, this man or his parents? It's like a theological case study for them. And Jesus says, neither this man or his parents sinned. He was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him. Which, if you think about it, is why we were all born. Every human person. So God's works can be revealed in us. And it's an interesting question. Who sinned? Who can we blame? And before we ask the question, we probably need to stop and think about what they meant when they used the word sin in those days. And we've talked about this before. To Hebrew people, they had a word that described what it's like to live at the heart of God's plan for the world. And this word was shalom. And shalom, we translate as peace, but it's a lot bigger than that in Hebrew. Shalom means everything that is rightly ordered and in its place, doing what it is meant to do. That's shalom. That's peace. Everything, doing what it's meant to do, right in right relationship to everything else. It's like harmony. When I was in college, I had to take human body, human anatomy and physiology. Would have never passed, but Scott Russell let me cheat off his notes, and he's really smart. But the first concept the lecturer introduced to us was homeostasis, or homeostasis. And it means this condition where the body's at equilibrium, right? That's homeostasis. When it's in its natural state in harmony, every functioning, everything, where it's supposed to be, functioning how it's supposed to. And if something isn't firing right, the body will notice it's not at homeostasis and try to correct it, right? So if you're too hot, your body starts sweating. You don't have to tell it to. It just does it. If you haven't had enough water, you get thirsty because your body's chasing homeostasis. Shalom, Jewish shalom, is a lot like that, only not just for the body, for everything that is. Cosmically, it's a homeostasis for the way that we, the person, relates to God, the way we relate to one another, to ourselves, to the world around us. And sin is what they call it when shalom is broken. It's disrupted. It's not just when you do something morally wrong and get in trouble for it or something like that. Sin is anything that disrupts the peace, the shalom. And in the New Testament, whenever Jesus sees a disruption in shalom, he moves against it always to restore the peace, which actually means the place of our brokenness, our lack of shalom, it serves a redemptive purpose. The place of our brokenness, our wounding, is where God does his best work in the world, his work of redemption. So when Jesus says he was born blind so that God's work might be revealed in him, he's saying, this is just how it goes for you guys, for us guys, the humans. This is why we've all been born, so God's work can be revealed in us, and that happens. The place that work happens is the place of our brokenness. So John is giving us a glimpse of what Jesus' entire mission is about. What he does for the blind guy, he's going to do for all of us, and indeed for the whole world. First for the church, in and through them, and this is going to extend to the world. I once heard N.T. Wright say it this way: the church is God's purposes for all creation being seen in advance through this community. So in a way, what God does for the church, he's going to end up doing for all of humanity. He's restoring shalom in you, in your life, and then in this place, this body of Christ we call the church, and then through that church, to the whole world. And to enact this mission, he heals a blind man. He spat on the ground, it says, and made mud with the saliva and spread the mud on the man's eyes, saying to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. Then he went and washed and came back able to see. The problem with this, technically, is this makes Jesus a Sabbath breaker. Doing this violates the law. And we talked about in and out last week. The Sabbath keeping was a big boundary marker for who's in and who's out for the Jewish people. There were things you couldn't do, and they were very strict about it. For instance, you could not cut your fingernails on the Sabbath. You could not pluck a hair from your head. Not a problem for me, but for some of you, this could be an issue. You could not wear sandals that had the sole of the sandal nailed to the rest of the sandal. If it was just woven, that was fine, but the nail was metal, and carrying metal on the Sabbath is considered to be work. Another thing that was forbidden was kneading bread or clay, which he did when he made mud. It was kneading clay. And another thing that was forbidden was healing. It was actually a very technical thing about this. You could actually receive medical attention, but only if your life was in danger, and then only enough medical attention to keep you from dying. So insert Obamacare jokes here, right? Which is ironic, given the fact that in Deuteronomy, part of the rationale for the whole thing, for Sabbath keeping anyway, was that so those who typically get overlooked in the hustle and bustle of life would be seen on that one day. It's part of the reason for Sabbath. You slow down and you see all the children and the slaves and the aliens and the broken people. And so Jesus heals a man on Sabbath, and he breaks clay. He works on the Sabbath and breaks the law, and this bothers the Pharisees. So they start doing interviews, right, with people, which is interesting because none of them seem to remember what this man looks like, which is odd because he sat outside the synagogue where they went at least three times a day. Have they not looked at him? So they bring him in and they ask him, they tell us the whole story, and of course they don't believe him. They call on his parents and they say, look, he's our son. He's been blind since birth. He can see. Past that, he's of age. Ask him what happened. And we're told his parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, in particular the Pharisees. The Jews had already agreed that anyone who confessed Jesus to be Messiah would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, he is of age. Ask him. Like, we don't want to be in trouble for his deal. So they call him in again. Verse 24, and for the second time, they called the man who had been blind, and they said to him, give glory to God. This is interesting. You know, they were forbidden to swear oaths. So this was like saying, do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Give glory to God means whatever you're going to say now, make sure it gives glory to God. It's basically a way of swearing him in. We know that this man, Jesus, is a sinner. And he answered, I do not know whether he's a sinner. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see. Which I don't know what they say now. When I was in college, we would say, ooh, face. Like, how embarrassing. Like, I don't know if he's a sinner or not, but I used to not be able to see. And I can see now. And then they said to him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? And he answered them, I've told you already. And you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples? He's making fun of them now. And you guys are obsessed with this guy. Maybe you secretly want to follow after him. Then they reviled him, it says, saying, you are his disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from. The man answered, here's an astonishing thing. You do not know where he comes from, and yet he opened my eyes. We know that God doesn't listen to sinners, but he does listen to one who worships him and obeys his will. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a person born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. They answered him, you were born entirely in sins. And are you trying to teach us? And they drove him out. The resolution there is really important because they drove him out of the synagogue. Right? Blindness, in Jewish law, it's a lack of shalom. It's unclean. If you're blind, you can't worship with the people of God. This man was blind since birth. He's never been able to worship. And for the first time, he's healed. And then he goes to the pool of Siloam. He does the ritual washing. He's clean. He gets to go to church for the first time ever. And what do? They accuse him and they throw him out. How messed up is that? And let me tell you, this stuff goes on all the time with religious folk. It goes on in our world all the time, right now. The people who are the problems for us, we want to separate them out, to shun them. Somebody who says or does something that the religious elite don't like, and they brand them sinners and heretics, and they do their best to drive them out. Somebody struggling with sexuality, with doubt, with addictions, with just mistakes, sins. Religious people seem all too ready to judge them and drive them out, and Jesus moves against it. So what's he going to do about it? This is so interesting. There's this tension right here in the text. What's he going to do? Verse 35, when Jesus heard they had driven him out, he went to find him. This is why I'm a Christian, you guys. This is it. When the Pharisees drove him away, when he got discovered to be broken in some way and they drive him away, Jesus goes looking for him. And this is what God is like. God is hunting down the blind and the broken ones, which is really good news because that's me. When he found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, and who is he, sir? Tell me that I may believe in him. He's like, whatever you want. I'll believe in whatever you want me to believe in. And Jesus said to him, you've seen him, and the one speaking with you is he. He said, Lord, I believe. And he worshiped him. If you remember last week, we read the story of the woman at the well. You can actually see these incredible similarities in these two stories. Remember the woman at the well, she's a Samaritan. She's a woman of ill repute. She's shunned by her community. She's at the well in the middle of the day. And she's talking about access to the temple and where they should worship, and she's calling Jesus a prophet. And here we have this man born blind, same stuff, shunned by the community, sitting in front of the synagogue this time where he's not allowed to worship, and he's calling Jesus a prophet. And when Jesus speaks with this Samaritan woman, she says, I know the Messiah is coming, right, who is called the Christ, and when he comes, he will proclaim all things to us. And Jesus said to her, I am he, the one speaking to you. It's the same exact dialogue. And here in our passage, Jesus asks the man born blind if he believes in the Son of Man, which in John is a messianic title. And in both cases, the woman at the well and here, he's revealing himself as Messiah. I'm the Messiah, the Christ, the one who has come to bring shalom, everything in its right place. And in the first story, it's the disciples who don't get it, right? The Samaritans do. Tons of Samaritans become followers of Christ. In the second story, the Pharisees don't get it. But this blind man, he gets it, the unclean guy. And this is huge. The revelation of Jesus as Israel's Messiah has this consistent impact on people. It produces belief on the part of some and blindness on the part of others. When Jesus is revealed as Messiah, it's like this polarizing thing. For some, they receive sight, and for some, it's like they're dumbstruck. They go blind. Verse 39, Jesus said, I came into this world for judgment so that those who do not see may see and those who do see may become blind. That's weird. Some of the Pharisees near him heard this and said to him, surely we are not blind, are we? And Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would not have sin. But now that you say we see, your sin remains. Okay, so what's he doing here? Over and over in the Gospel of John, Jesus is described as the light of the world, right? This is a big thing in Gospel of John. John 1:5, the light shines in the darkness. This is how his birth is described. John 8, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of light. And then again, here, right in this chapter, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. So Jesus has come as the light, but we're also told he comes as a judge. So he's the light and he's a judge. And when he's done, the blind can see. And the seers are blind. The man born blind experienced Jesus very different, in other words, than the Pharisees did. Jesus is the light that helps the blind man see, but he's the light that exposes the Pharisees, exposes those who are not living truly. And it blinds them. It's like a flashlight. If you're in a dark room and a flashlight hits you, you can't see anything, right? You're disoriented. It's when it hits your eyes, you can't see. It blinds them, and it exposes the things that they try to hide in the dark. So when the light shines on the woman at the well, who had, you know, five husbands, and the man she's living with now isn't her husband, it makes her whole. Because she has nothing to hide. And she confesses the Messiah. When it shines on the man blind from birth, it restores his sight. He's able to see and confess Jesus as the Messiah. When it shines on the Pharisees, it blinds them. It exposes them as the source of the fractured shalom in the Jewish community. They're the cause for the lack of shalom because they refuse to be humbled when God shows up. And they refuse to welcome those who don't have their act together. Those who are broken, they're not welcome into their worship. And then they refuse Christ as Messiah. I mean, the problem here isn't so much that the Pharisees are wrong, it's they're unwilling to admit they're wrong. Jesus is never scandalized by people who don't have it all together. But he can never stomach the fakers and the hypocrites. Call them actors. Those who convinced themselves they were perfect. I'm not the problem. You're the problem. They don't find healing because they can't admit they're sick. They don't find wholeness because they think they've been made whole by their own righteousness. And so when Jesus shows up in John, he's called the light of the world. Those who are in darkness, the blind man in the story, he's the light for them. They can see. But those who think they're in the light, the Pharisees, He's a light for them too, but it's a light of judgment. It shines a light of truth on their lives and shows it to be the source of sin. It's the same light though. Jesus, the light of the world. That makes sense. I mean, this is weird, but it's uncanny how accurately this describes life. To some, the light of Christ means healing. To others, the light of Christ means judgment. Wrath. It's the same light. You know what makes the difference in the story, at least? What makes the difference is the answer to the question of his identity. The woman at the well confesses him as Messiah and Lord. The man born blind confesses him as Messiah and Lord. Pharisees, not so much. Verse 39 again, I came into this world for judgment, so that those who do not see may see, and those who do see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard this and said to him, surely we are not blind, are we? And Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would not have sin. But now that you say, we see, your sin remains. It's a stunning thing to say. If it was this blindness, you know, if it was obvious and you just came out with it, that's not a problem. I wouldn't call you a sinner. He's essentially, by the way, in front of the Pharisees saying, the man born blind isn't a sinner. He's just suffering under the effects of sin in the world. But he's guilty of nothing except for being a human being, a broken human being. His blindness is a lack of shalom, to be sure, but it's really not the source of the lack, the source of the lack of shalom. And so Jesus draws near to him because he's asking for help. This is a radical thing that he says here. It actually begins to unravel the Judaism of his day. I mean, it's a bomb that drops in Judaism. If you were blind, you would not have sinned. But now that you say, we see, your sin remains. You struggle with some sort of brokenness. You have a blindness physically, emotionally, relationally, spiritually. Jesus does not hold it against you. He doesn't hold it against you. He moves into it. But you discard other people because you don't like their blindness, or you don't like their whatever, sexuality, their politics, name it. Whatever you, how any way you could separate the world and divide them out. You hold yourself up as righteous and shun them. Jesus says, that's blindness. And you think of all the times we spend condemning other people, the sinners, and say we can't be part of them. Jesus just blows it up in John chapter 9. He's like, nuh-uh. No way. If you were really blind, like dealing with a serious problem that you just can't handle, I got grace for that. I got grace upon grace for your brokenness. But you become so convinced that you're the righteous one and everyone else is wrong, and that's blindness. And if you do that, the lack of shalom, it's on you. So if sin is the disruption of shalom, then Jesus is saying the reason for that disruption is not merely on the blind man. It's on the community. It's on the Pharisees because they refuse to welcome him into their community. Turns out they're the ones who are really blind. It's stunning. It's a stunning teaching. There's a man named Jean Vanier who is one of my heroes. He was Canadian, but he grew up in France. His parents were part of the Foreign Service. They were in the diplomatic corps for Canada, and he grew up in France, and then he was brilliant and went to the Naval Academy and became an officer in World War II, and then left and got his PhD and wrote on Aristotle. He's a total brain. He was a committed Christian, but he was never sold out on the Navy, never really sold out to education, to the academy, and he had this mentor named Father Thomas, who is a chaplain at this home for people with severe mental disabilities. And kind of as he was trying to suss out, what am I going to do with my life, he went to stay with his mentor at this home for people with mental disabilities. And he became really bothered by the way this all functioned in society. He thought they were casting aside human beings too easily by institutionalizing them, kind of quarantining them, mostly because they were misfits in culture and not treating them as human beings. So one day, Vanier decided to adopt two men from the facility. He just took them home with him. and they started living with them in his house. They were both severely disabled. They had no family. And he just took them into his home, and he rechristened his home El Arsh, which means the ark, because he brought them in two by two the first time. And all they did was share life together. All he did was just live with them in his house. And they worked around the house, and they built a friendship, and they kind of had this makeshift family. And the results were stunning. For one thing, Philippe and Raphael, they were the two men, they became happy. And they started to suffer less from their symptoms. And all of the troubles they had been having in that institution, they started to go away as they became part of this little ragamuffin family. They still had their disabilities, right? But they began to flourish. And then the next thing that happened is people from the town started showing up to help. They're like, this is good. This is good stuff. We want to be a part of this. How can we help you guys? And supported them. Within 6 months, Vanier had been asked to take over that whole institution where his mentor was the chaplain. And he converted it to this El Arsh style of community. 5 years later, they started another one in India and Canada, and they haven't stopped. Last time I checked, there were 147 different communities in 35 countries around the world, these El Arshes. There's one here. It's in Overland Park, where people just live together. Most of them are just small homes. They're not professional communities. But the boundaries between the sick and the well are gone. They've been erased. And the residents just live together and work together as friends, as co-laborers. Vanier is convinced, he writes about this a lot, he's convinced that these broken people are actually so misunderstood. They're actually the conduits of God's grace for us. They're the place where God shows up in the world to heal. He says that the reality that Jesus seemed to know and everybody who was religious seemed to miss is that the weak and the broken have this hidden power. And the power is they can't mask their own weakness. That's what health gives you the ability to do. That's what wealth, affluence gives you the ability to do. You can mask your brokenness. You can tamp it down. You can hide it, put it away in the dark. But there's this light, right? There's this light that's coming to the world. Broken people, they can't do that. They just share it. They embrace it. And when they do, it unleashes the power of God. It invites the presence of God that inhabits weakness. When they expose the ways that they're all broken, it's as though Christ is very near to them. Vanier notes that when you work with the mentally disabled, most people think that success in that situation is when you can develop them to the point where they can live by themselves. And so, of course, this is what they tried to do. And they found very quickly, almost everybody that they kind of gave the life skills and then moved them in by themselves, you know what happened to almost all of them? They became raging alcoholics. Isn't that wild? Because what they needed was community and friendship. They didn't need to be alone and isolated. And what Vanier has come to teach is that independence does not lead to health. It leads to loneliness. Interdependence leads to health. Community, love, friendship. This is shalom. Human beings are wired for connection, not autonomy. We're wired for mutuality and love. And what endangers our shalom is not our brokenness. It's not our issues. What endangers shalom is when we allow that brokenness to cut us off from the body of Christ and God's grace that inhabits weakness. Sometimes we do this ourselves, you know, we can't be real with each other. We hide, we act for the church. Sometimes we do this to one another when we shun each other, the same reasons the Pharisees did, right? And the Pharisees, in the end, they don't miss out on God's grace because Jesus is mad at them. He's the light. They miss out on it because they don't want everybody included. They want to control who's in and out. They thought shalom would come. They were sincere in this. They thought shalom would come when they pushed all the sinners out. And all that was left was the holy, the clean. And they didn't want to be in communion with the blind man, even after he had been healed. They still drove him out. So Jesus, in this story, he completely redefines sin for his people. In the Gospel of John, sin is really not defined as moral good or moral evil. It's defined in terms of what is your relationship to Jesus. How do you relate to this Messiah? Can you bend your knee to this man who's bringing peace into the world? And specifically, do you believe that God is present in him, making the world new again, bringing shalom? He's the light of the world, and he shines on you. And if you say, heal me, I am broken, then grace can explode into your life and restore you. And if he shines on you and you say, I'm good, I don't need healing, and I can't expose my brokenness, it's too whatever, humiliating, shameful, then the light of Christ exposes that as a lie and is the root of the disruption of shalom. In our own lives, when God sees us, when God sees you and your life, especially the parts of your life that are not as they're meant to be, our own sins and brokenness and wounds, we carry around our failures, our fears, our anger, our shame. He does not count that against you. He views it with nothing but compassion and love and forgiveness. And so we have no right to count that against those around us who are merely in the same boat. And this is a great change that Jesus brought in the way that we view God. For those of us who call Christ Messiah, our view of God has never been the same. Our view of who God is, it's fundamentally different now. He doesn't run from our brokenness. He runs toward it. He doesn't shun us for our sin. He moves toward the sin and redeems it. The place of our deepest wounding is the place of his best work. And the only way to blow it is think that you don't need it or try to keep it away from others. And in the end, the man born blind, he could see. And it was the Pharisees who were blind. Let's pray for a moment. I just would invite you to sit with me and ponder a couple of questions that I think this text pulls out for us. The first one